Health and Human Services. Senator Benson, you have Senate File 1173 in front of us. Continue on with that.
Madam Chair, members, we'll have professional staff from the agency come up and pick up where they left off. Council has prepared a document to help us understand some of the changes, and so we'll have Ms. White. Are you prepared to talk through changes?
Okay. Yes, Madam Chair and Senators, Lee is handing out a document that I prepared with the help of the Department of Human Services, which shows the changes in the statutes related to the new adoption assistance chapter in 259A. And Article 1 contains language that's currently in a couple statutes and several rules that are being repealed in Article 3. And the goal is to consolidate the adoption assistance program provisions into one chapter to provide more clarity and put it in a logical order. And most of the language in Article 1 is existing law, rule, or necessary to comply with federal law, but there are some substantive changes. And this table below lists the changes in existing statutes. Article 1, Section 1 is a definition section. And the new definitions, there are several, are in subdivisions 3 to 6, 9, 10, 12 to 15, 17 to 20, and 22 to 28. The other definitions are existing definitions in statute but are moved into this chapter. Now, these are terms that are used throughout the adoption statutes that are now being defined to provide just more clarity in dealing with this program. Section 2, Subdivision 2 just adds a current procedure to statute related to the agency's responsibilities for AFDC 4E determinations and notification related to adoption assistance. Subdivision 3 is new and different. It directs the commissioner to establish procedures to implement the program rather than promulgating rule. And according to DHS, this allows the commissioner to respond to changes in federal regulations in a more timely manner. Section 3, Subdivision 2, is a change. Deletes child is 5 years of age or older as a characteristic, making it difficult to place the child without adoption assistance. And according to DHS, this will have an impact on less than 5 children. Subdivision 2 is required to comply with federal regulations, requires the requirements of documented search for adoptive parent without adoption assistance. Oh, and then also you'll see to the far left, that's the new section number, and then to the right of that is the old law where the language was lifted. On to page 2. And also, I have the numbers, the 7.7, that's the page and line numbers referencing the actual bill. Subdivision 2 is required to comply with federal regulations. It requires child placing agency to document if parent is willing to adopt without adoption assistance help. Subdivision 4 is another federal requirement. It precludes state-funded adoption assistance payments to a person with barrier crimes. Subdivision 5 requires non-federal financial portion of adoption assistance for non-Minnesota Indian children placed in Minnesota be paid by agency, the agency assuming financial responsibility. This is a change, and according to DHS, the state does not have an obligation to pay for a child who is the financial responsibility of another entity. Subdivision 6 is no change to current law, just consolidating terms related to exclusions into one subdivision. Section 4, Subdivision 1 is currently in rule, and it's moved to statute, and it adds adoption assistance certification form to statute. Subdivision 1 replaces the term high risk with at-risk child, and this is one of the new terms that's defined in Section 1. Subdivision 3 is new. It replaces assessment tool, or the term assessment tool is replaces the supplemental maintenance needs assessment form. this is an assessment that's done on the children to determine their eligibility for adoption assistance. And the language in the bill says that the new assessment tool must be prescribed by the commissioner. So I'm not sure what that assessment tool is. Section 5, subdivision 1 is just adding current procedure into statute relating to payments of adoption assistance. Subdivision 4 relates to non-medical expense reimbursements, and I think this is all new language. Child care will be paid only for a child 12 years or younger or for a child 13 or 14 who has a documented disability. And this is to align with the child care assistance program. The next is child care for parents to parents for work or school only up to a four-year degree. Currently, there's no limit, and this is a policy decision by DHS. Camp reimbursement for special needs camps only. Home modifications, reimbursement for those once every 5 years. And vehicle modifications, those would be available once every 5 years. And these are all different policy decisions in the bill. On to the next page, which are not numbered. Birth to 3, developmental disabilities and specialized services, specialized communication devices are eliminated. According to DHS, these services are available through other funding sources. Section 6, the changes in this section either are to comply with federal regulations or move the current rule into statute. Section 7, in subdivision 2, has correct and true information language that clearly states potential consequences for noncompliance with reporting responsibilities. This is similar to the language that's in the combined application form for MFIP and food support and MA. Section 8, there's no changes. Section 9, subdivision 2 relates to the assignment of adoption assistance. That assignment is only permitted with the death of an adoptive parent. This is a change. Current law allows an assignment of adoption assistance due to the death of an adoptive parent or the termination of parental rights. Section 10, the changes in subdivision 1 and subdivision 2 are to comply with federal law. Permits exclusions only to age 21. Currently, the law, Minnesota law, is 22. Subdivision 2, a child adopted over the age of 16 must be dependent on adoptive parent for care and financial support to be eligible for an extension of adoption assistance. Subdivision 3, eliminated requirement to apply for other public benefits prior to the application for extension. This is because the eligibility for other benefits does not impact the eligibility for adoption assistance. Subdivision 3 is current procedure added to statute related to eligibility conditions for the extension of adoption assistance. 11 and sections 11 and 12, there's no substantive changes. Section 13 was deleted with the A1 amendment. Section 14, subdivision 5, is new language, and it clarifies the difference between the 4E and non-4E medical coverage for children on adoption assistance. Subdivision 5 is a change. It omits the current requirement that adoptive parents annually show that the adoption assistance agreement is in full force or has been renewed. Subdivision 6 omits specific language regarding penalties for false claims and replaces it with a general requirement for adoptive parent to comply with the Medicaid program. And this is because the adoption assistance program cannot enforce compliance with the Medicaid program. Section 15, there's no substantive changes. Section 16, subdivision 1 adds current procedure to statute relating to the purchase of a contract for services. This section of law has to do with reimbursement to the agency for adoption costs. Subdivision 2 eliminated the eligibility for a child under the guardianship of a Minnesota private agency. Subdivision 3 is also a change. It narrows eligible services to only placement services for children under the guardianship of the commissioner. Current rule allows for reimbursement of several more services, such as recruitment, counseling, training of the adoptive family, home studies and case management, and referral services. Subdivision 4, also a change, clarifies that service hours for siblings placed together should be planned for maximum efficiency. Subdivision 5 shifts responsibility for documenting service activity from the financially responsible agency to the agency that's actually providing services. And Subdivision 6 is also a change. It requires agencies providing services to maintain records.
Thank you, Ms. White, for your work in the interim, and appreciate that. Are there any questions? Senator Bergel?
Mr. Chairman, I know that there is some concern about part of this bill, and it is listed in this little summary as, you know, procedures that are currently in statute or federal law. And I'm wondering if we could, before we're done with the bill, at least give an opportunity to hear from people on that issue.
Absolutely. Certainly. Senator Higgins, did you have a question?
Not about this table. But.
Okay, all right. Senator Benson, do you want to resume the testimony on the bill? Or?
Okay. So, Ms. White was filling us in, but yes, if we're finished with Section 1, are we prepared to move on?
I don't see any questions being raised right now, so yes, let's continue.
Good evening. And we're working off of the Senate bill, and starting with Article 2 on page 23 at line 23.25. We didn't intend to be discussing much under Article 2 because jurisdiction for most of these provisions are with judiciary, but the Senate counsel has advised that some of these do belong here, and so we'll be covering a few of the sections here this evening.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, can Senate counsel tell us what the distinction is, what would make it jurisdiction of judiciary over this committee? Is there an easy answer to that?
Ms. White.
Is there a workable answer to that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, Article 2 generally has to do with court proceedings related to child permanency, and it has to do with the court findings, if the parties, what parties are involved, and it has the whole court process, which is not under our jurisdiction. However, in some of those proceedings, they impose duties on the Commissioner of Human Services. So that is under our jurisdiction when there's something, when there's a responsibility imposed on a department head that's under the jurisdiction of the committee. So the court proceedings are not under our jurisdiction, but the responsibilities of the commissioner are.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. So the first sections that apply to this start on page 44 with section 25 through sections 29. Section 25, subdivision 5, is provisions for relative search. There were some substantive changes in the relative search provisions, and there were even more substantive changes that were included in the amendment that you adopted earlier today. that if you want to kind of include discussion of both at one time, if that would be helpful.
What page are we on?
We're on page 44, starting with line 4415. Okay. The amendments, I said, changed this even more than we had. And so starting on line 4421, there's an amendment that inserts, if you want to look at it on the amendment, if you have the amendments handy, it is on lines 5.4 through 5.10, that the court has to have findings of reasonable efforts and continue searching for relatives, to continue consideration of relatives as a possible permanent option, and to order to reopen relative search at any time during the proceedings. So that's the first major amendment to this section. The next major amendment to this section is on line 4423, and there's an insert there. On your amendment page, or on your amendment, it is lines 5.12 through 5.18. This amendment includes that information about relatives will be gathered by meeting with the child in talking with them in an age-appropriate way about who relatives are or other important people in their lives that may be able to be considered for a permanent placement for the child. That amendment also includes provisions for meeting active efforts standards under the Indian Child Welfare Act to prevent the breakup of Indian family. The next change in this area is on lines 44.31 through 44.33. These were amendments that we made. The significant change here is that if a relative decides early on that they do not want to be considered as a placement resource, that may affect whether the relative is considered for placement, the child is considered for placement later on.
Mr. Chair, do you want questions now or when we're kind of through with this section?
Senator Higgins, I think if we've got questions as they come up, let's try to deal with them so that we don't have to go back and try to...
I have a question on this piece, then.
Please, Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Borsheim, the changes that are made makes it look like if a relative does not want to be a permanent placement resource or participate in the planning for the child, current law would say that that's kind of the end of it. And you're changing it to make it look like somebody might decide after all that they would be considered a permanent resource or a permanent placement?
Ms. Borsheim.
Is that what you're trying to do? Because
yeah,
that's what it looks like.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, yes, that is what we're trying to do. I think that overall the provisions and the amendments really require a more rigorous and comprehensive relative search on the part of county agencies when kids go into placement. But even with those rigorous search, sometimes there's a relative that may not have been in a position to come forward early on in the case, and it would be an appropriate placement for that child later on. And this doesn't exclude that relative for filling that role for the child if it's in the child's best interest. Now, the may effect means that, you know, if the child was in another permanent placement that, you know, was able to kind of assume their care and custody, then that might be ruled out as a potential for that child.
But Ms. Borsheim, if I'm reading this, and I think that was Senator Higgins' question, current law says that the fact that the original search, or they did not want to be part of it, then that cannot affect future placement. And what the change is saying, well, it could. Isn't that what the law is, yeah, the change is doing?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes. If I wasn't clear, you're right. It was before they could not be considered. Now that opens the door for those relatives who may come forward at some time after the child's been placed.
Okay. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, it doesn't make it very clear, however, Ms. Borsheim keeps talking about sometime in the future where somebody might change their mind. But it almost is written, or it's written so it could be interpreted as this relative may not have any choice in the matter and that the child just would be placed with them. And I don't think we would want to do that to either child or adult. But I'm not sure that, I mean, I know I'm tired and I could maybe just be misreading this, but I think I'm not.
Senate Counsel could give us some, we're talking about the language, I believe, on 431 to 432, mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes.
And
Ms.
White, can you clarify that? What is the, I'm reading that to say that if a relative decides to not be identified as a permanent resource or participate, they could still be considered at a later date to be so. Is that correct?
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, that's correct. They could at a later date decide. Again, I think much of what's in this provision is that we're giving notice to relatives throughout the placement of that child, making sure that they're aware of what's going on with the permanency planning for the child. There is nothing in this provision that we would place children with relatives against the relative's will. They have to be basically expressing their interest to either be a permanent resource or to participate in planning or some kind of care with the child. But it's their choice. There wouldn't be children placed with relatives otherwise.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Borsheim, obviously these recommendations came from, this is not strictly just a department recommendation. These came from?
Borsheim. Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, the new amendments that were part of the A1 amendment were provisions that we agreed to or worked out with legal aid. This was subsequent to this bill being introduced in the House. They raised some concerns and believed that we hadn't put in strong enough language around relative search, ongoing efforts to engage with relatives, and so many of these amendments were agreed to. And by the way, the department believes they were good amendments, that they improved this part of the bill.
Senator Byrne?
Mr. Chairman, I know that it happens that a relative is called and they decline because they believe there is a different relative that's going to be responsible for this, and then later find out that that relative for some reason couldn't do it, and so then they do want to be considered.
And my understanding is that this, the change in the law would then permit them to,
right.
But previously they could not be considered. Is
right.
That correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Senator Higgins, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Borsheim, you said that the amendments that were in the A1 were from conversations from legal aid. And I'd like to know what other stakeholder groups have been involved in all of this bill,
mm-hmm.
The amendment, the bill itself, because I'm concerned that they have not been fully involved in this and have a lot at stake, kind of like stakeholders do.
Ms. Borsheim?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins. The department, and particularly in the Child Safety Permanency Division, has a number of standing committees, task forces, work groups that we are on an ongoing basis consulting with stakeholder groups. We convene an African American Disparities Committee that meets every other month. We help staff that committee, and their sole purpose is to advise the department or the division on matters of child welfare policy. We conduct ongoing review of child welfare work around the 87 counties. In any given year, we are conducting interviews, basically hundreds of interviews and focus groups with kids and moms and dads and relative caregivers, people from the courts, and basically around those efforts or to decide or to determine with them what is working in our child welfare system and what is not working in our child welfare system. The feedback that we go in, that we get from those reviews is kind of a continuous feedback into our child welfare system. And many of those considerations were taken into, that input was taken into consideration in preparation of this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Ms. Borsheim, did you specifically go through the provisions in this bill with the African American Disparities Committee?
Ms. Borsheim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins. No, this bill was not formally reviewed or endorsed by that particular committee, although many of the provisions in this bill have been topic of agendas with that committee over time.
Mr. Chair, Ms.
Borsheim. Senator Higgins.
Did you go through the provisions of this bill with the Disparities Reduction Advisory Committee?
Ms. Borsheim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins. No, we did not. That committee is not an advisory committee to the Child Safety Permanency Division.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Ms. Borsheim, did you go through the provisions of this bill with the councils of color?
Ms. Borsheim.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, no, we did not. Many of the members of those communities sit on our various task forces and have been part of conversations about these provisions over time.
But you just
Senator
said,
Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Borsheim, that you didn't go through this bill with any of those advisory committees.
Ms. Borsheim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, we did not go through this bill with any of those committees. We had approval to share this bill with our stakeholders about 2.5 weeks ago. We distributed it as soon as we were able. And we have been sending out documents to our stakeholders groups and offering to meet with anyone who is interested in meeting with us. We've also included sending out summaries to people to help them interpret what was included in the bill.
Mr. Chair,
sorry,
that's not acceptable. These are really major changes to this section of law. And to not talk to the stakeholder groups and to go through this bill so that not only they can give their input, but that they know it's coming, and you know that they then go out and talk to all the folks they talk to. This is a disaster that the stakeholder groups have not been consulted with and worked with. And Mr. Chair, I think we should go no farther with this bill until that is done. And so, Mr. Chair, I'm going to move to lay it on the table right now.
Senator Higgins has moved to lay the bill on the table. I don't believe that is a debatable motion. So we will take that up. All in favor of laying the bill on the table, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
I believe that we will continue to discuss the bill. Before we continue, I did want to ask Ms. Borsheim, Senator Higgins has raised a question about stakeholder groups, and my question is that the practice of the department with, I'm assuming you've had bills of this nature in other sessions, that this is a department policy bill. Is that normally the practice that these provisions are reviewed with a set group of advisory groups or others, and that was not done in this case, or just could you describe the normal process involved here?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It would be very typical of our practice to review in our entire bill with various stakeholder groups. Part of the issue this year was timing, and as I mentioned, we had a large bill that took a long time for approval. As I said, we have a policy in our agency that until the bill is approved, it's embargoed, and we are not able to share the language. It was also a very large bill, so it was difficult to send out. I would say that it's not typical for us to bring something forward that is this really this large in terms of just sheer volume of pages and the number of sections that are included. It's not typical at all. So, yes, we would typically meet with those groups, present the bill, get input. But I would like to reiterate that I'm aware of the concerns. We've heard the same concerns from the same stakeholder groups that you have heard, and I'm sure at least many of you have heard. We take those concerns very seriously. That is why we agreed to meet with legal aid, advising us on particularly this area of the bill, but on other amendments that were included in the A1 amendment. But I don't think that we can characterize our development of this bill as having no stakeholder input. As I mentioned, we meet with stakeholder groups continuously. There are actually some provisions in Article 3 of this bill that come directly from recommendations made to the department from the African American Disparities Committee.
Just a second. Senator Berglund, you'd raised a few minutes ago a question. Is this the question you're raising pertaining to this issue with respect to the review of the bill prior to
it? Mr. Chairman, I don't know about the particular groups that Senator Higgins has raised a concern about, but I do know that there are still some concerns about the language in the bill, and I felt like this little page, I'm not disparaging the work, I know Senate Counsel got most of their information from the department for the chart, and it says that, the department says. But I think some of the places where it says that, there is some disagreement. And I just want to make sure we hear about that. And, you know, I am not one that thinks we should just shove it off to the next committee. If we can find a way to get language that would resolve that here, then I think we should try to do that.
Well, I agree with you. I don't. I think this is the committee that's appropriate to hear the policy. This is a department policy bill. I guess what I'm a little concerned about is if there are significant issues being raised about whether this bill is ready to be acted on. And given that we've got a lengthy agenda this week and a deadline on Friday, and this does have to go to another committee. This particular bill does, at least part of it. I guess I'm going to ask Ms. Borsheim if we decide that we can't act on this bill, how critical is that to the department's agenda, I guess? I mean, is this something that has things in it that just absolutely have to be dealt with? Or if we decide we want to put this off and give it some more opportunity to be talked about, is that what's the response from the department?
Mr. Chair, and I guess I'll just kind of respond to it. I think the summary that the Senate Counsel did only refers to Article 1. I don't think there's any stakeholder groups that have any issues with the work that was done in Article 1. So as far as I know, that has not been an issue. In fact, we had actually stakeholder groups meeting for several months helping work out that language. So I don't think that's the issue. There are several provisions in Article 2 and some provisions in Article 3 that are necessary for us to be in compliance with federal regulations. Some of those do line up with us being able to maintain, stable funding. We have federal funding sources. So my response to that is to lay it all aside would create difficulty. And we are in the process of actually going through Article 2 and some of Article 3 to determine which sections are necessary to move forward this year because of federal compliance issues. And we haven't completed that work.
Senator Rosen, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am having just a complete brain fart here. But
it is late.
I'm sorry. It's about that time of day. But Ms. Borsheim, there is the Chief Justice Kathleen Glatz formed a group that had all the stakeholders in it. And for the life of me, I'm texting my assistant to what is the name of that group that has all the stakeholders, Senator Higgins, that you were talking about. And my question to my original question is to see if a lot of this information is coming out of a group like that. And I know earlier today, Aaron. What's Aaron's last name?
Ellen Sutton.
Thank you. Was here and has chaired that stakeholder group together. So, like I said, this is very sketchy here, but I believe that if this has been vetted through this group, or a lot of these recommendations came from that group, it would perhaps take care of Senator Higgins' issues. I don't know. Is this, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
What is the name of that group?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, that's the Children's Justice Initiative.
Oh, thank you. CJI.
The department, the Children's Justice Initiative is actually an initiative that's kind of co-sponsored by the Supreme Court and the Department of Human Services. The person who put together much of the language for this bill is a person that works for the Children's Justice Initiative and the Department of Human Services. Most of Article 2, because it does have to do with the Juvenile Court Act and juvenile court practices, has had input from that, not necessarily that initiative, but certainly the Children's Justice Initiative teams that exist around the state. I think if you're familiar with the makeup of that, there's a state group, and then each county or judicial district has their own local teams. And we actually made a round of all judicial districts last fall. Again, many of the provisions that are under the court pieces of this really respond to the kinds of things that we hear from the courts.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Borsham, are you meeting with any stakeholder groups this week to talk about these provisions?
Ms. Borsham.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, we have a meeting scheduled for 8 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Higgins.
What other days are we meeting this week?
Senator Higgins, we are meeting every day this week.
Okay, then. Mr. Chair, could I suggest that we lay it on the table to allow the department to go have those stakeholder meetings, get that input, and put it back on the agenda some other day this week?
Senator Higgins, well, let's see. Today is Wednesday, I think. We are meeting tomorrow, and then we have Friday, which will be a long day already because we are going to try to assemble the bill on Friday, and there have been some additions to that. I guess if we postponed it, I would not want to postpone it further than tomorrow.
Very far.
And does that give – I don't know if that gives enough time to the department to do the things that you're suggesting. I recognize there's some concerns here, and perhaps it might be useful to – try to find the areas that are of concern and separate those from the bill and process the rest of it and then take the parts that are problematic, assuming they are not critical to the concerns that you mentioned, and we could either deal with them at our convenience, I guess. But
I think Senator Benson wants
Senator Benson, yeah.
Mr. Chair. This does need to go to judiciary, but I am not sure that all three sections need to go to judiciary, and I'm wondering if council can advise if it's just section two, perhaps we delete section two, finish our work on sections one and three, let section two travel on its own as amended to judiciary later this week, and then we can deal with it on its own later. Again, if sections one and three need to go to judiciary, we need to expedite this process.
And, Senator, I think we could do that. I don't think that we would get Section 2 back in our committee in time to deal with it by the deadline. So if there are things in Section 2 that need to be Article 2, in our policy bill, they would not make it, I don't think, unless the House has met that deadline. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering if this bill has met deadline in the House, and if... You know, does this have to be traveling in an omnibus policy bill, or could it travel on its own later?
And Senator Berglund, I think we were planning to have this go separately anyway, and I don't know if where it is in the House, or in the, and perhaps Senator Benson, do you know if it's...
It is past the House, fundamentally as drafted, as you see.
Article 2 is gone in the House.
Did they take out Article 2?
Yes.
Okay,
Ms. Borsheim, can you clarify what is the status of the bill in the other body?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The in the other body, the bill was heard this morning in Judiciary. Article 2, Article 3 were deleted from the bill. So the bill, as it was amended, now stands with Article 1 in Article 4, which was the child support amendment that was made. I believe it was passed on, excuse me,
to Ways and Means.
To Ways and Means.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Sir Higgins.
If we take Article 2 would be what would have to go to judiciary, right? If we do like the House did and take 2 and 3 out, then it doesn't have to go anywhere else. So that helps us with some time as well. So I think what Senator Benson was saying was, I mean, she was going to try to take 2 out and send it to judiciary, but maybe the thing to do is just to take 2 out, just take it out.
I think that Senator perhaps Benson. That defeats, Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, the purpose of the bill. There's substantial work that the department needs from Sections 2 and 3 in order to come into federal compliance. So somehow to Section 1, we seem to all agree, is going to move forward and it'll be just fine. So if we need to take that out, we can. But 2 and 3 are kind of the meaty parts of the bill. So somehow we have to figure out how to move that forward. We leave them sort of trapped.
Senator Berglund, did you have a suggestion?
Mr. Chairman, my suggestion was not that we just take whole articles out of this bill, but either we set it aside and ask parties to go work on it and come back to it tonight, or we hear from the parties that have concerns and see if we can't get them resolved. That would be my preference. And obviously, if the bill's going to judiciary and they're having a meeting in the morning and there are additional concerns, those could be brought up in the Judiciary Committee to get resolved. But I do believe some of the things that are in here are needed, and I think some of the other things improve things for communities of color. And I just can't imagine that it's going to be that difficult to resolve the things that are not yet resolved. And when I chaired this committee occasionally when we ran into this, I told people to go out in the hall and we'd take their bill up later. And they usually and worked it out.
Senator Berger, I think that's a good idea. I'm certainly open to do that. I don't know that there are representatives from the stakeholder groups here that if there are concerns that we could get those resolved tonight. I don't think.
Well, there are representatives from Legal Aid.
Representatives from Legal Aid. And we certainly can hear from them. If that's what you're referring to, I'd really be happy to do that. But we could certainly, if there's a concern about trying to get the bill into a form that we can process and meet the critical issues that the department has and yet set aside some of the things that are more problematic, if that's possible to work that out and then bring the bill back
tomorrow.
Later, well, or even later this evening, if that can be decided here in the next, you're shaking your head, no, maybe not.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
I think if they're having a stakeholder meeting tomorrow, we would benefit from the information of that meeting. So I don't know how long the agenda is for tomorrow, but maybe tomorrow would be easier on us all. It would also give them, the department said that they were trying to identify the pieces in Articles 2 and 3 that they absolutely had to do for federal compliance and that they weren't done with that work. Would give them a little more time to get that done, too.
Let me just, what do we have on the agenda? We have 2 bills tomorrow, I believe. One is the policy, health care policy
for
DHS, and the other, My Life, My Choices, which is
Sessions.
That's right. We have 2 hours, and we have 2 bills on the agenda. I guess it's possible that we could take up this bill as a third. We might run into a little bit of a time crunch. Are we meeting tomorrow evening as well? Or we're not? No rooms is what I hear. Maybe we could meet in our office.
We'll go up to 328 with you.
Pardon me?
We'll go up to your office.
Yeah.
That's right, we could do that. Senator Rosen, do you have a question or comment?
Well, I just, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to address the stakeholders group thing again, because I do believe, Ms. Borsheim, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you have been in conversation and in advice of the Children's Justice Initiative, that does take in a lot of these stakeholder groups that have been involved. Am I correct on that? And I'm not quite sure if we need to go back to the stakeholder group. I think if we bring up Legal Aid and maybe, I don't know if somebody from CJI is here that can testify on that, but when I attended those meetings, all these stakeholder groups were there. And
so I'm sure it's well covered.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, but the department has identified stakeholder groups, the Disparities Reduction Advisory Committee and the African American Disparities Committee, and they are their stakeholder group, and they haven't been working with them. And so I think that even though they may have said something to the Children's Justice Initiative, I don't think they worked with their own stakeholders groups to get the input they should have had. So, and I think that's the people they're meeting with tomorrow morning. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, we have sent out a meeting invitation to representatives from the Legal Aid Office, the Office of the Ombudspeople, some private adoption attorneys, some county attorneys, some county social service agencies. Adoption advocate agencies. That's who we're meeting with in the morning. I would, however, just as a point, because I do know that you said that we have not been working with those groups, I would like to clarify that we do work with those groups. That is different than the fact that they did not see this bill.
So, Mr. Chair?
Just one second. I'm reminded that we have session tomorrow, which would be our opportunity to move this bill to judiciary and we're not meeting until after session tomorrow. So if we lay this over, take it up tomorrow afternoon, then it would not make deadline if it has to be in judiciary. So counsel is asking the question whether the problems we are dealing with are in the jurisdiction of the committee or in the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. Senator Newman.
Just a question, Mr. Chair. Does judiciary know it's coming? And the only reason I ask is because judiciary is meeting right now, and there's three of us that are here right now that sit on judiciary. And I can tell you that their plate is every bit as full as this committee. So I'm just asking the question, do they know what's coming?
As far as I know, we have gotten a request for it. So I assume they know, and it's on their agenda, I understand. So,
and Mr. Chair, it made deadline in the House, so they've got all next week to do it.
But I understand they took this article out in the House. Is that correct?
The Judiciary Committee took this article out in the House.
But if that has the policy that is a concern to the department, then it would have to make our deadline to be active. Or am I getting that wrong?
It's still the command.
Then it would.
So we could deal with it next week, and so could judiciary, Mr. Chair.
What happened to our author? Our author has disappeared.
Mr. Chair, I do have
Ms. Borsche.
I do have a question.
Yes.
Of Senator Higgins, if that's okay, because you were asking who we've been working with and who's invited, and you indicated certain groups that you believed we should be working with. I don't know that each of those groups is on the invitation list. I did mention to you that the Community Disparities Group is not an advisory group to the Child Safety Permanency Division, so the representatives from that group have not been invited. If we were going to be meeting with groups and meeting the, the expectations of this committee, I just want to be clear about who will be there and who won't be there.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Higgins.
I'm sorry. So Ms. Borsham, maybe I'll just do this. Mr. Chair, so I think that's even more reason that we lay it aside so that if they have to have two stakeholder groups with the other groups that that weren't invited for tomorrow's meeting, and we could tackle this next week, it would give everybody a lot more breathing room.
And we could take this on next week, assuming it has met the deadlines in the other body, and that's not clear to me that it has. And if I get the affirmative that it has, then we certainly can do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, didn't Senator Benson say that it got referred to Ways and Means, which would mean the equivalent of our Finance Committee?
Right. And Senator Benson, is that your understanding?
It is my, I checked that it went through Health and Human Services. Now they tell me in Judiciary they took out parts of it, and that was referred to Ways and Means. So I will have to investigate exactly which parts have moved through all of the necessary committees in the House.
Mr. Chairman, each part doesn't have to meet a deadline. It's the bill itself. And I think it's important that we try and work this out so we don't just have those articles missing in our version. But if we have next week to do it, which it sounds like we do, then maybe we should do that.
I do want to, at the witness tables, I know you've been wanting to make a comment. Please identify yourself. And
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Ann Martineau with the Department of Human Services. The House companion to this bill has met deadline. And it was referred to Ways and Means. And it is true that Article 2, and they don't exactly line up the articles in this bill and that bill, but the provisions of the bill in the House that were under the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee were deleted from the bill. But the bill has met deadline.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, and then I'm hearing there are concerns about the provisions in the bill, and so I'd like to just get a sense of what the committee would desire to do. Would it be the desire of the committee to put this off until next week and give an opportunity? I see Senator Higgins giving an affirmative. Are there concerns not to do that? Are people desiring of moving it right now? Is anybody in the camp of let's just do it now? Senator Berglund, are you okay with
that? I thought we could get these things resolved tonight, but if we have more time, then maybe taking more time is a good idea, because I know we've got a lot of bills besides this one tonight, and it's already after 7, so.
Senator Benson, are you all right if we postpone the continuation, that we could lay this on the table and take it up?
I am, Mr. Chair, amenable to laying this on the table. However, I would like clarity tonight for the department exactly what stakeholder groups are expected to have input on this so that we don't have to revisit.
Could that's fine. And could we have that conversation offline with the persons concerned? And if that's okay, then we would need a motion to.
You, Mr. Chair, you can just lay it on the table.
Well, that's right. I can do that. Yeah. Sorry about that. All right. Well, we will lay this on the table and take this up at a future date. Thank you, Senator Benson. Thank you, Ms. Borsheim. I think next we have Senator Hall, and he is back from, I think he was in Judiciary Committee. Senator Hall, Senate File 1134.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senate File 1134 is a bill that does some modifying to body art regulations, licensing, training, and storage of waste. It's a technical bill, and I have with me a testifier, Ms. Rennell, from the Department of Health, if I could have her testify.
Ms. Rennell, please identify yourself for the record, and we'll be happy to hear your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Rennell. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. The body art statute went into effect July 1, 2010. Since that time, Department of Staff has kept a log of calls coming in from practitioners and clients. Review of that log has determined there are 5 points of confusion, primarily for the practitioners. The following 5 have been identified and are in the bill for correction. It's just clarification of language. First one is supervised experience. One of the 3 types of technician licenses that are issued is a dual license, which means a technician can do both tattooing and body piercing. That means that they would both have to have 200 hours of supervised experience in both areas, or each area, and that is the change that we'd like to make. The second one is the coursework. All technicians must complete continuing education at every renewal. The first renewal is kind of problematic because the technician conceivably could go 3 to 4 years without updating their coursework. And that is the second thing that we'd like to clarify. Third is the contaminated waste disposal. As it stands now, the statute references the federal statute, and what we're doing with this bill is just to insert the federal language into the bill for just the plain language. The fourth is the title of the fee section. We have two different types of licenses, technician and establishments, and technician licenses are renewed biannually, and establishment licenses are renewed every 3 years, and the title actually says biennial, so that has caused a lot of confusion. The fifth and final is the fee for establishments. All establishment licenses, when they're initially issued, are initially issued as provisional. What that means is they have not yet been inspected. At the time that they are issued, they are given an expiration date, and upon inspection, they will just be converted to a full license, and the expiration date will remain the same. There is no additional fee, but that has caused some confusion because people think that the provisional is something completely different from the post-inspection license.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Questions? Seeing none. Senator Hall, is this something that needs to go forward independently, or do we want to include this in our policy bill?
I only assume it would be independently, but that's up to you.
Do you know how this is being handled in the other body?
I don't.
All right. I'll tell you what. We will, as far as I know, this does not have to go to another committee. And we will, it's all right with you. I think we've just passed it to the floor. And if we need to bring it back on Friday, we will. But
okay.
We can find out what's going on in the House in the meantime.
That's good. So I would move then.
One question here.
Okay.
It's been suggested that we put this on the consent calendar. Is there objection to that idea? Then why don't you make your motion?
Okay. I move the Senate file 1134 move on to the consent calendar.
Senator Hall moves that Senate file 1134 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor on the consent calendar. Yes, Senator Nino.
And Mr. Chair, if I'm not mistaken, this will be your second bill on the consent calendar, will it not?
Call you Senator Hall the king of consent.
It's I know so... I know so much about body art. I think that's it.
That is the only
on that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Those passed. Thank you, Senator Hall.
Yeah. Thank you.
Next, we have Senate File 1135, Senator Newman. You are ready.
I'll be right back.
I'm taking them to the cleaners.
This is a crappy bill.
That's what he told me.
And is this a consent calendar bill, too? Right. Senator Newman, this looks like a very technical bill. I'm not sure if we're prepared to deal with it here.
Well, we're going to give it a whirl. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate file. What are we dealing with? Senate file 1135. Deals with a task force involving maternal and child advisory or child health advisory, and I will tell you that this is an agency bill, members, and a little bit of the background that I can give you is that I was a little surprised when I learned that this is a task force that was put together initially, I think, in 1982. And periodically has been extended, and the purpose of this bill is to the department is asking the extension be extended until the year 2021. I do have a couple of questions that I will ultimately be asking, but I think I will have the testifier from the department kind of fill you in on the bill itself.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Maggie Diebel. I'm the director of the Community and Family Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. The Maternal and Child Health Advisory Task Force, which is authorized under 145.881, is scheduled to expire on June 30th. As Senator Newman said, we're asking that the sunset date be extended. This would allow the Commissioner of Health to continue to obtain valuable guidance and advice on public health issues that impact maternal and child health populations in Minnesota, especially those who are at particularly high risk for poor health outcomes. It would also help to facilitate Minnesota to meet federal requirements related to public health input to the federal maternal and child health block grant funding that we get, and we have to submit an application on an annual basis, as well as to do a five-year needs assessment. And it also helps to facilitate consumer, provider, and local public health input in supporting, as I mentioned, that five-year annual assessment. The legislation directs the task force to advise the commissioner on the health care needs of mothers and children, the type and frequency and impact of publicly funded services, program guidelines and criteria considered essential to providing effective services, priorities for funding, and then also to help us establish statewide outcomes against which we measure the health status of mothers and children. The task force is comprised of 15 members, and this is outlined in the statute. Five of them are maternal and child health professionals. Five are consumers and parents. We have a couple of consumers on the task force now that are parents of children with special health needs, as well as five members from community health boards. They are appointed by the Commissioner of Health to four-year terms. In addition, we have a number of ex officio members that bring additional expertise to the task force. Currently, these members include representatives from the Department of Human Services, Department of Education, University of Minnesota, Minnesota chapter of the March of Dimes, St. Paul Ramsey Public Health, and Health Partners. Examples of where they have provided advice to the commissioner recently are in issues related to infant and child, as well as adolescent mental health, infant mortality in the state, particularly among more recently African American and American Indian communities, and, for example, childhood autism spectrum disorder. The task force meets four times a year. There is a minimal cost to that, but the cost to support the task force, including per diems and a little bit of staff time, come out of the federal maternal child health block grant. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Chair, if I may, there are a couple of questions that I do want to ask. First of all, in terms of the memberships, it's my understanding that no employees of the Department of Health can be members of this task force, but I believe other state employees can be. Is that correct on my part?
Mr. Chair and members, there are no members on the task force. However, members from other departments serve in the ex officio position on the task force. So they're there to provide guidance and advice, or if the task force has technical questions related to maternal and child health issues, they're there to provide that guidance. Staff from the Minnesota Department of Health do provide staffing support to the task force.
And Mr. Chair.
Sir Newman.
I did pull the statute that's referenced in the bill, 15.059, and it does talk about compensation for the members of being currently. It's $55 a day for a per diem plus some expenses outlined in a commissioner's plan. Excuse me, a commissioner's plan. My question is, do the ex officio members who are state employees, share in that compensation of the per diem plus the expenses outlined in the commissioner's plan.
Ms. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, no, they do not. They participate as part of what would be considered their ongoing work.
Senator Newman.
And Mr. Chairman, finally, the statute that I referenced, 15.059, talks about two different deadlines or expiration dates. The one that specifically talks about advisory task forces indicates that if there's no expiration date, the task force shall expire 2 years after the effective date. This particular bill is asking for an expiration date of the year 2021. I just feel that that's an awfully long task force, especially given the fact that it's been around since 1982. And Mr. Chairman, I would offer an oral amendment that in accordance with Minnesota Statute 15.059, subdivision 6, the expiration date on the bill be amended to read 2013. That would be 2 years.
Senator Newman has offered an oral amendment changing line 1.15 from the last, I don't know if it's a word, but the last group of numbers from 2021 to 2013. Before we vote, Ms. Diebel, any comment on the date? Is there any particular reason why 2021 was chosen?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the department greatly values the advice of this advisory task force as it concerns the health of mothers and children. And it has indeed been a longstanding task force, and I think this was a way to sort of simplify our continuing efforts by not having to bring it before the legislature on a more regular basis. I will say that the House did also amend the sunset date and put it at 4 years. We would appreciate the support of the of this committee for continuing the task force at whatever time frame you feel is appropriate.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, do you envision going to a conference committee on 2 years?
Senator Newman.
Senator Higgins, that's a very good question.
Might you want to, Mr. Chair?
Senator Newman, it might be to that point, if you made your date conform to what the House's date would be, that would maybe simplify the process, but that's up to you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and I tend to agree. I picked the year, the two-year date, simply because there is a statute in Minnesota that specifically addresses expiration dates for advisory committees. In the spirit of compromise, I don't really see a whole lot of difference between 2 years and 4 years, but I do see a great deal of difference of the year 2021. So I will incorporate in my amendment a change in accordance with Senator Higgins' request for 4 years rather than 2 years.
And, Senator Newman, does that mean that is 2015 would be your amended amendment, oral amendment?
That is correct.
Any questions on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill is amended.
And then, Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
I think this would go to the consent calendar.
Well, Senator Higgins, it could be controversial. I don't know. Senator Newman, any advice?
I'd like to try the consent calendar. I've never been there.
All right. All right.
I would move that this matter pass out of the committee and move to the consent calendar. Thank you, Senator Higgins.
Senator Newman moves that Senate File 1135 be recommended pass and sent to the floor to the consent calendar. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Bill is passed. Senator Newman, thank you, and Ms. Diebel, thank you. But Senator Newman, before you leave, you have a couple other bills on the agenda. The one that's listed next, 1285, requires testimony from department folks who are over in the other body testifying on this bill, I think, in the other body. So I would recommend we move that to the end.
That'd be fine.
We could take up, even though it has my name on it, members, it was introduced under my name, but we did switch the authorship of the bill on the floor. It's also true for Senate File 1289 on the back of your agenda, and that is also now Senator Newman's bill, I understand. Is that correct, Senator Newman?
That's correct. As long as I'm sitting here, you want to take that?
As long as you're sitting there, and just members for your information, the last one on the list, Senate File 1305, has been deleted from the agenda. So after Senator Newman deals with Senate File 1289, we can take up the other two, 1287 and 1286, and then come back to Senator Newman's bill at the end of the calendar. That's correct. Senator Newman, Senate File 1289, if you are ready.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1289 is a bill that, and I'm going to ask the members to be kind to me, I read it about 10 minutes ago. It is, or deals with the appeals process for certain administrative issues, and I have been handed an A1 amendment. Which, in order to put the bill in proper form, I would offer at this time.
And does council have copies of the A1? Thank you. Let's take a look at that before we... Senator Newman, I'm looking at the A1 amendment. It looks like technical language changes. Is that correct? Council is nodding.
Yeah, that's what it looks like to me, too, Mr. Chairman. And maybe council could address it, but I believe it's just a technical change.
Senator, Ms. White.
Yes, Mr. Chair and senators. The bill, as it's drafted, adds some new language onto an existing paragraph. However, it really doesn't relate to what happens in that paragraph. So this just creates a new paragraph for the human services judge may issue interim orders as necessary to further the appeals process and gives it its own paragraph.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Senator Newman, do you have any other comments you wanted to make on the bill itself?
On the amendment itself.
Yes, I'm sorry. We need to adopt the amendment, the A1 amendment. Any further questions? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? A1 amendment is adopted, and so the 1289 as amended. Senator Newman.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, this again is an agency bill. And I read through it just a few minutes ago, and I can tell you that on page 2, line or beginning at line 2.2, there is some language that has been deleted. It appears to me that similar language has been moved to a different position in the bill at page 4, beginning at line 4. I've looked at the language on page 3 that is new language, and that would appear to me to allow for administrative hearings to proceed forward if there isn't a district court action that is currently underway. But if the district court action is dismissed or resolved, then the administrative action can move forward, and that would seem to me to be appropriate. And then they have listed some new crimes, which would be a basis for a disqualification. page 4, the new language underlined 4.4, that appears to me to be where the language has been moved off of page 2. And I'm hoping that the testifier from the department will be here shortly, because I do have a couple of questions on with respect to that new language. We now have a testifier here from the department, Mr. Chairman, and with respect to the language, if I could have just an explanation as to the final disposition or final action that is being appealed from, and a request for a hearing is allowed, what final disposition are we dealing with, and where is the hearing to be held that is being requested?
And please identify yourself for the record, and then you may answer the question.
Hi, I'm Karen Mickelson with DHS.
Thank you. Ms. Mickelson.
We've got our appeals judge who will be here to testify momentarily. On this part, the hearing is at the agency, DHS hearings. We have our own judges that hear appeals from various recipients or providers.
Okay,
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand now what that language is, and I think what she's referring to is that there's a disposition of an issue, and an appeal can be taken to a DHS referee, and that explains that language to me. Mr. Chair, members, down line 4.22 and 2.3, that is going to allow.
Senator Newman, we have an amendment before us that deals with that part of the – that deletes that new language and adds other new language. Is this a
– This is my amendment.
Oh, this – I'm sorry.
No, this is a different area, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry.
The amendment dealt with interim orders. The language I was referring to on 4.22 deals with – using interactive TV in order to hold a hearing, and that certainly seems appropriate to me as a time saver. And then the final language deals with some change in terminology. Historically, what is the judicial officer within the Department of Human Services, to the best of my knowledge, in fair hearings has always been a DHS referee, and apparently they are changing the language to make reference to a human services judge. And then that language is carried on over onto page 6. So as I understand it, Mr. Chairman and members, that is the bill, and perhaps the human services referee that is now up at the table to testify could address, and you were out of the room, and I had indicated I think the language from 2.2 has been moved over to 4.4, and if you could confirm that and then maybe explain the change in the language from a human services referee to a human services judge.
Certainly. Please introduce yourself for the record, and then.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Chair. My name is Lewis Thayer. I'm the co-chief human services judge with the Department of Human Services, and of course, I was out and had one of those just bad moments as I was trying to find a vending machine just to get a cup of coffee. And here we are. I'm late. I apologize to all the members of the
committee.
It is
late, so.
If I can go first to the reference to human services judges, the technical title of the position is appeals examiner, and we made the working title for the position about 6 years ago, human services judge. And so we've all of the documents that we've produced, all of the notices that we send have the title human services judge. It's comparable to an unemployment comp judge, an administrative law judge, And so we just thought that there's multiple references in statutes to human services referees, appeals examiner, human services judge, I believe, in one reference in the maltreatment statute. We just thought human services judge was a consistent way of defining our titles, and just wanted to make a reviser's amendment to have all of those references changed to human services judge. I recognize that in the House version of this, there was some controversy about that, and they decided to go with the title human services referee. The second part, though, I'm sorry, Senator, the change on section 2.2.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, the other changes, I had represented to the committee that the items beginning at line or page 2, line 20, that are lined out have been moved and are now incorporated in the bill at page 4, beginning at line 4. And I just wanted to make sure that my representation was accurate.
Mr. Thayer.
Thank you, Senator Chair. What we were attempting to do with that section was to simply show that the change that happened in 2009, where we added in the revenue recapture, that's the ability to get debt that's owed to the state or to the counties through tax seizure. The authority to hear those cases was given to the Department of Human Services appeals referees. And what happened when they made that addition, they took the last paragraph of our statute, which said that people had up to 30 days to file an appeal or up to 90 days with a showing of good cause, and it got tacked on to just the revenue recapture point. So it looked like it was only amending the revenue recapture area. And what we wanted to do is to give that its own paragraph as it had been prior to 2009 so that it's clear that any type of administrative hearing that we might review would be the same, that 30 days or up to 90 days with good cause.
Thank you. Senator Berglund, and did you want to take up? Yes, please.
So I have the A2 amendment. My understanding is that the department has agreed with this amendment, but possibly in the process of changing authorship, it maybe fell through the cracks. So the amendment simply says that when a person is assessed, when a person has an appeal or a witness is needed in an appeal that has a physical or mental disability that would impair their ability to participate in the interactive video technology, that then the hearing would be held in person.
Okay, thank you. Senator Newman, are you familiar with the amendment at this point?
I'm not, Your Honor, but I have been handed one, and I'm in the process of reading it. If I could just have a moment.
I don't know if I've been promoted to be a judge or...
Is that what I called you?
Your Honor.
My apologies, Your Honor.
Oh, boy. I apologize. I did not realize the authorship on this bill had been changed, so...
No, that's fine. You indicated, Senator Berglund, that the department has agreed to the change, and does somebody from the department would like to comment on that? Well,
Mr. Chair, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm with Legal Aid, and I'm sorry. We did work this language out with the department. The original amendment that Legal Aid wanted, the department did not agree to, but this is the language that we worked out with the department. All of this language has been stricken in the House, so it's my understanding that the department doesn't have any concerns with this language.
And Mr. Thayer?
Thank you. Chairman, Senator Berglund, that's correct. What happened in the House is that we had been working with Legal Aid, and the representative in the House, Representative Liebling, had some concerns that the video conferencing process did not seem quite fair to the people in greater Minnesota, and she decided that she could not keep that language in her version. Prior to that, Legal Aid and I had been talking, and we had worked out some language that we thought would be helpful so that people, if they had a mental or physical health disability or their witnesses had that challenge and could not participate in a video conference, that we'd be amenable to having this language, and that's what that amendment does. But in the House version, it was completely stripped.
Senator Newman.
given the fact that if it's not in the House version, quite frankly, it seems reasonable to me. But if it's not in the House version, I would just as soon keep it clean, and I would oppose the amendment.
Senator Newman, Mr. Chair,
Webster.
The underlying bill, the IVT technology, was stripped from the bill. So right now, the bill has no language allowing for video conferencing. This allows the department to do video conferencing, but makes an exception for people with disabilities and mental illness.
Mr. Chair, I misunderstood. I thought the amendment was turned down. Given that fact, the A2 amendment seems eminently reasonable to me, and I would support it.
All right. Any other questions on the amendment? Senator Berglund offers the A2 amendment to Senate File 1289. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senate File 1289 as amended.
One more thing, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I could inquire of Judge Thayer, is it correct that in the House version, the language concerning the title was changed to Human Services Referee?
That's Senator Newman.
Mr. Thayer.
Chair, that's correct. The language in the House was changed to Human Services Referee. I would just add, if I may, the change in the House, I think, was at the behest of an oral amendment. There were some concerns about confusion around the title Human Services Judge versus Human Services Referee. I think the focus was on the word judge. Again, we've been using this title for about 6 years. We haven't had any problems with it as a working title for the positions, and I do believe it's comparable to, again, an unemployment compensation judge, an administrative law judge, and a workers' comp judge.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
My recollection is that statutes do talk or make reference to a referee, and given the fact that the language in the House makes reference to a human services referee, I would make an oral amendment to change the bill, and council would maybe have to, throughout the bill, make it or change it to read human services referee instead of human services judge.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I guess my question on this is, for the last 6 years, has the department been slowly changing things to say human services judge in whatever bills you've had? And now in this one section, it would go back to referee. Does that make sense?
Mr. Thayer.
Senator Higgins, Chair. We've used it in all of the documents that we've produced for the agency, all of our notices of hearing, all of our decisions. We've got about 6,000 of our decisions online that have been redacted, but they have the title Human Services Judge. References in statute, there's at least 4 different references. There's appeals examiner, appeals referee, human services referee, and human services judge. We haven't been before the legislature to try and clean all those different areas up. This was our attempt to try and do that.
So, Mr. Chair, Judge Thayer, it seems funny to keep talking about the House because, I'm Senate trained and we usually don't talk about the House, but so is the piece where Section 4, the revisor's instruction that says take those 4 titles and make them all the same, is that the piece that the House changed to be human services referee rather than human services judge? Or was it just in the other pieces of the bill?
Mr. Thayer.
Hi, Karen Mickelson. I wasn't there earlier today when they made that change, but it's my understanding it was only 2 sections, and it was not the revisor piece. Was the other.
And
Mr. Thayer.
Thank you. Senator Higgins, Chair. That's correct. There were 2 pieces. I believe it's at, in my version, it's line 6.6 and 6.7, where you have the reference to human services judge. They changed that to human services referees. They I'm assuming it was just a miss. They missed the reviser statement to change everything to human services judge. That is still in their version for the reviser to correct everything.
So that would mean that if the bill were to pass, the changes they made would go back to being human services judge because of the reviser instruction. Is that correct?
Chair, except for those two pieces where they said human services referee.
So, Senator Newman, I guess what that means is if you changed your bill to be consistent with what the House did, it would not have any effect on the language in the bill.
Before, Mr. Chairman, before I withdraw my oral amendment, I do want to correct Senator Higgins that we do pay attention to the House, because just a few minutes ago she told me to make an oral amendment so they could go to the consent calendar. We didn't have to go to conference committee. So she was incorrect when she made that reference.
No, I'm inconsistent. That's it.
Well, and
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Newman,
I withdraw my oral amendment.
Senator Newman, it still is going to have to go to conference since the language on 4.22
yes.
and 2.3 is different in as amended in this bill from what the other body has done. So Senator Newman withdraws his oral amendment. We now have Senate File 1289 as amended before us. Any further questions or comments? Senator Newman, I don't think we can refer this one to the consent calendar.
I think you're right, and so my motion would be to recommend it to pass and that it be sent to the floor.
Senator Newman recommends Senate File 1289 to pass and be referred to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Newman. And we will return to you in a few minutes. We do have two other bills that I am the author of. Maybe I could ask Senator Rosen if she could chair. And we will do 1286 and 1287. I want to make sure we have department staff here for 12. Yes, I'm seeing the heads nodding. So let's.
Yeah, me too.
That's right, the royal we. That's right.
She kept smiling at me, and I think it's coming anytime.
I go over my eyes at one of your girls, so I would like to say, come on.
I listen to Senator.
It's a good thing someone does.
This next one, I've got is just.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have two bills. Let's take them in order on the on our agenda. 1287, Senate File 1287, which is some modifications to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And the committee may recall we did have a hearing the other day with Senator Berglund on a bill that we are offering to change some of the provisions of the sex offender program. This bill that we have before us does not do anything to the status of that bill. This is, as I understand it, some technical is the right word to describe them, but modifications in the program. And I guess it would be my preference to have the department talk about the content of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Hamm. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Robin Vu Benson. I'm legal manager for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Welcome, Mr. Vu Benson.
Yes.
Good evening. I'm Sheila Brandt. I'm the Legislative and Stakeholder Relations Director for MSOP.
Welcome, Ms. Brandt.
And Madam Chair, I will do a walkthrough of the bill. My walkthrough, though, will focus kind of at the article level rather than getting down to section by section in the interest of expediency. Article 1 of the bill expands existing procedures for the voluntary readmission to a secure facility for a civilly committed sex offender who has been transferred or provisionally discharged. It also adopts the existing revocation procedures or adapts those procedures to transfers. Article 2 strengthens and clarifies state agency and law enforcement authority and roles in apprehending and returning a civilly committed sex offender who is absent without authorization. Article 2 also ensures that the current felony escape statute covers all Minnesota sex offender program clients in all situations. Article 3 streamlines the sexually dangerous person and sexual psychopathic personality civil commitment procedures to a single hearing instead of two. Article 4 ensures that public notification of the broadest scope is available under the law that is available under the law is used when a civilly committed sex offender is going to reside in the community. Article 5 is a correction to an inadvertent technical error that was made last session. As corrected, it gives effect to what appears to be the legislature's intent from several sessions ago. Not quite as bad as human services judge, kind of confusion, but it hopefully clarifies it. And finally, Article 6 directs the Department of Human Services to work with the revisor's office to develop legislation for next session to reorganize sex offender civil commitment statutes so that those statutes are clear and distinguished from other civil commitment populations. Like I said, that was a overview of the articles. I can certainly talk in more detail about specific articles or sections therein.
Thank you, Mr. Vubenson. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vubenson?
Vubenson, yes.
All one word?
Hyphenated.
Words. Okay, got it. Mr. Vubenson, Article 4, the community notification, this is a new process that you're implementing, is that correct?
It is a new part of an existing process.
Oh, okay.
The existing process that is over, oh, sorry, Madam Chair and Senator, it is an add-on to the existing DOC process where they have assigned risk levels 1, 2, and 3. What this does is it ensures that even when a sex offender is only a level 1 or a level 2, that the scope of notification is the same as for a level 3 offender. So a level 2 offender, the notification would only go to an employer or nearby child care center, whereas level 3 is where you have the community meeting and you have a much broader dissemination of information.
Senator Higgins. Madam Chair, this is only for people who have been civilly committed and are being released out into the community? This isn't changing the DOC's process?
Vubenson.
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct.
Okay. My question, Mr. Vubenson, is there a separate bill addressing this issue, Article 4, that's floating around? Or I recall there's a... I hate to say the word, but something in the House that's a little more strong than this. Is that right? Are you familiar with that?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware other than the companion bill in the other body.
Okay. Senator Murray.
Madam Chair, thank you, Jim. Mr. Vubenson. Article 1, the voluntary readmission. I'm just curious, and I've got much over the years. Who voluntarily goes back to this? Is this happen regularly?
Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Marty, this is a adaptation of an existing process in the mentally ill and dangerous statute that allows for someone who's been out in the community on provisional discharge, or in this case, we're adapting it to transfers and provisional discharges. If they are feeling heightened levels of stress or otherwise sensing that they're not going to do so well, it's an opportunity for them to voluntarily readmit for a temporary time period to restabilize and then return to the community without jeopardizing their provisional discharge or transfer status.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I remember a news item about one sex offender a number of years ago who felt he should not be out in the community and so on. It's that sort of situation, and this happens from time where somebody readmits themselves or wants to readmit themselves because of it, to address that issue.
Mr. Vubenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator. It would address that situation if that individual had been placed out in the community. Presumably, if they're civilly committed and they don't think they should go out, then they're not going to make it that far in the process. But for many of our clients, they've been institutionalized for years, if not decades, and the return to the community has a large degree of stress associated with it, stress that might initiate an offense cycle.
Mr. Vu Benson, the Article 1 in Section 2, the director can revoke a transfer or require the patient to remain in the secure facility under certain circumstances. Can you explain that a little bit more? I mean, what were the options in the past, and what are the circumstances
today? Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. The way that it's worked with the mentally ill and dangerous statute, which is applied to the sex offender civil commitments in the absence of a more particular statute, which this one would be, is that if someone comes in off of a provisional discharge voluntarily, they're there for up to 60 days. At that point, if they're not readmitted or re-discharged back to the community, which is a sign that they have not stabilized or that they have perhaps decompensated more, that's where the authority is to hold them back and not allow them to return. Also, if once they're back in the facility voluntarily, if the facility identifies a basis for revoking their provisional discharge based on what they've learned from the individual or from collateral sources, then they can revoke that. Now, the procedures that are provided here are the same as that are provided in the existing law. So there is an appeal process for the individual if they disagree with that decision.
Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of stuck on what paragraphs, mostly paragraph B on page one, how that works. Something about if a patient isn't returned to the facility where they were originally transferred, then the transfer is revoked. I'm stuck. I don't understand how it works, and I'm wondering if you could kind of walk through that in a real life kind of situation,
Mr. Vivian.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator. It certainly is a mouthful, and attempting to draft it in a way that's clear yet also informative is not always easy. So, to explain what the real life situation would be, currently, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program has a less restrictive facility called Community Preparation Services. It has supervision, electronic monitoring, but it's not behind a razor wire. So that's where individuals are transferred to by the court as the last stage of treatment before provisional discharge. The way that this would work is if they have voluntarily returned back to the secure facility because of the service or services or types of groups or even just the stability of that setting, and it reaches the point where they've not been, they're not ready to go back within 60 days, then this provision says that if they're not returned to community preparation services, that facility that the court had transferred them to that doesn't have the razor wire, then by operational law, their transfer becomes revoked and they have to stay in the secure facility until a court approves a second transfer, or if they were to appeal that revocation, if that revocation were overturned. So does that, hopefully that.
It helped.
It's a picture.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Senator Hain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there's no additional questions, I would like to move Senate File 1287 and recommend it be passed and referred to the floor.
Senator Hanna, I believe, has to go to judiciary.
Oh, is that correct?
But it meets the deadline in the House.
It needs to go to judiciary. Yes, it would, wouldn't it?
Probably. Right.
Mm-hmm. I hope they have time to take this up. I'll amend my motion to refer 1287 to the Judiciary Committee.
Senator Hanna moves that Senate File 1287 be recommended pass and sent to judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Hamm.
We're still here.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I've just been informed on Senate File 1286. The testifiers are over in the other body. And I don't know if the testifiers who are here to talk about Senator Newman's bill are here.
I do not see them. Madam Chair, I don't believe they are.
Okay. Senator Hanna, would you like to just start
Well,
I mean, is it something that you need some help? Okay.
This is an agency bill. I'm not.
Half hour recess.
You know, Senator Hahn, how about if we just take a short little recess, and
just got my
assistant will we'll check on the status over in the House and see if we can pull this together. So perhaps let's say 20 after 7 or 20 after 8. Would that be okay with you, Senator Hahn? Sounds good. So we will meet back here in 15 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just have a time when everybody open that.